You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to the Dressage Today podcast, sponsored by Equestrian Plus. This month, we've got the wonderful pleasure of interviewing Dr. Wendy Rice of the ADD Equestrian and Rice Psychology. We really hope that you enjoy getting to hear her talk about imposter syndrome in riders, how it shows up, and some tips and tools for having less of it in your life. We'd love to hear any feedback you have on the interview, and we welcome any questions you may have. In addition to that, always feel free to email us, either one of us, at the addresses provided in the transcript for Ask the L questions for Aviva. And if you like what we're doing, make sure to subscribe and share with your friends. Aviva, good morning.
Good morning, Steph. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
A little bit hot. Looking forward to cooler weather.
Wow. It is warm. It is super warm right now. I had a couple good days at the beginning of last week. It was just a little bit drier and I actually was able to ride in the field and I thought, okay, maybe we're hitting towards fall. And then no, big fat no,
no.
Showed up about Wednesday and I'm like, nope, I'm having to do a lot more laundry because, you know, there's only so many sports bras in a week.
So. Oh, yeah. I sometimes change clothes as many as five times.
Oh, man.
In one day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, because I still don't have a wife, I have to do my own laundry.
I know.
And I'm just like, really? I'm not going to see anybody today. So I'm just going to be dirty and disgusting all day long. I'm just going to be okay with that. So.
Yeah. So do we need to worry about your ranch during this upcoming hurricane? Are you far enough inland that you're safe?
We're in an interesting spot because we're at the top of a very, very large lake. Now, and I say at the top, we're like 30 miles north of it. So it's not like we have to worry about, you know, a breach in the lake and all. But there's this thing called the lake effect. Mm-hmm. So when any kind of weather comes across the center of the southern center of the state, the lake a lot of times will split it.
Okay.
So it goes north and it goes south. And sometimes that very phenomenon minimizes the effects of whatever's going on. At this point, we're not worried.
Good.
I haven't seen any Florida panicking. Nobody's buying beer and bread.
Toilet paper.
Yeah,
got it.
So no, we should be okay with this. We actually are really dry. We got a little bit of rain. It's been a very dry summer for us. So
it's been very weird up here in Maryland as well. We get, you know, torrential rain and literally within 24 hours, it's dry as bone again.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's been rough.
Mm.
So, but I was looking out my window today and wow, it is so green and it is so lush.
Mm.
We did get a little bit of rain last night, but you know, it's dry out there. It's just the weirdest thing. You know,
well, we're limping towards fall.
Yes.
That's what I keep saying.
I'm looking forward to being cold.
Yes.
And complaining about being cold rather than being hot.
I kind of have a rule for myself. I set this rule a long time ago. I will complain when it's hot, but I will not complain when it's cold. I will complain when it's dry. I will not complain when it's wet. So if we get a lot of rain, I just kind of go, well, you know, you can't complain about this. So, with it being cold, I just put more clothes on. So yeah, it's kind of one of my weird little rules.
The older that I've gotten, the less I have been able to tolerate heat. I don't know how you guys do it in Florida. And you know, I love it's not the heat, it's the humidity. And you know, it really is true.
Yes.
I was in Phoenix a couple months ago and literally the temperature was 104.
Yes. And you didn't feel that bad, did you?
That's really hot. You know, 104 is really hot. But if you go into the shade, it's hot and you sweat and it dries.
Mm-hmm.
If it's 90 in Maryland with 75% humidity,
you are dying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sweat never dries.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
that's the problem.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, they have all that research now about how, you know, how do you cool your horse? And, you know, we used to scrape our horses and now they say, don't scrape your horse. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense to me, except if it's this humid, mm-hmm. how do the horses dry?
Yeah. That's the problem that we have, you know, because we're subtropical where we're located. Wellington is subtropical. Ocala, not so much. Ocala is a little bit, you know, a little bit more temperate, but it literally doesn't cool off here at night. It can still be 84, 86 degrees at night here.
Ugh.
And that's the problem for the horses, is that they never get a break for several months.
Yeah.
My young horse came down from Indiana, and this is his first summer, and I'm watching him. He seems to be a very practical kind of guy. He's handling the weather pretty well. But it's always good when you bring a horse over from Europe or you bring a horse down from, you know, the north. That first summer is really critical, how you allow them to adapt to the weather here.
I'm sure.
Because once they stop sweating, it's not something that you can't go, well, I hope that doesn't happen next year. You got to go, okay, what are we going to plan for next year? So,
well, that's when you sell them back to somebody in the north.
It's crazy.
I've seen that, unfortunately, more times. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they can sweat up there because they get that little bit of a break at night.
Yeah.
So what's been going on in your world lately?
Oh, just keeping busy teaching and judging and sweating.
Sweating. Yes.
And planning, and, you know, my horse is still just a wonderful unicorn. And in 5 years, I get to do our century ride, and I've already got my judge lined up and
awesome.
Not the test yet, because it depends on where we're going to be in 5 years, but super excited about it.
So, cool.
What's up
Very
with you?
Cool. Sweating.
Yeah.
Sweating. I'm kind of getting to the end of my time at home. I've gotten a bunch of, you know, little niggling projects done that you don't want to do, but knocking those out because I'm getting ready to start traveling again. I was teaching this past weekend and my freestyle is done. And I have to say, for somebody who doesn't do this for a living, I did a really good job with my music.
Good for you.
So yeah, my little, you can't really tell. Like, I can tell because I've listened to it 72 times in a row.
Yes.
But somebody who's listening to it one time, they're going to be like, hey, where did that change happen?
Yeah, that it's seamless. Good for you.
Yeah. And I've run through it a couple times and it's pretty, it's tight, but when I'm on, like, there's some things that I didn't even know I was doing really well with the music. And I'm like, look at that. That was great timing. Look at me.
Good
for
you.
So I'm excited. It makes me
happy. Well, I'm waiting for you to send it to me. Send me a video of you doing
it. That would involve a second human being on the property.
Yes, it would.
Because I was like, I need to video this, but I can't listen and video. How's this going to work?
Yeah, Pivo.
Pivo, yes. Somebody else's Pivo.
Yes.
So I'm really excited about our interview today with Wendy. I think people are just going to get so much out of it.
Yes.
She's a very humble human being. She's a normal horse person. You know what I mean?
And that's unusual.
Yes. I mean, I'm not sure normal as a person, but, you know, for a horse person, she's a normal horse person, and she deals with the same questions about herself that the rest of us deal with, and her psychology practice has just been a wonderful addition to the horse world, that she's managed to put these two things together. So I think people are going to get a big kick out of listening to it. So, but before we do that, why don't we do an Ask the L question?
Okay.
And this one,
it's from Sarah, right?
This is Sarah's question. Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Yes. She wants to know about second level. And I love that we're doing a little bit higher stuff. You've been doing that right along, which is great. What happens if at second level, instead of staying in the counter canter, or instead of doing the simple change, a horse does a flying change? How do you handle that? What could you expect from a score on that?
Well, that is a mistake. You know, there are a lot of things that happen in tests that make the movement more difficult. And if it is performed well, you get sort of bonus points for it. We don't really say that because we want accuracy. But if you, you know, if you're doing a 15 meter circle, you're supposed to be doing a 15 meter circle and you do a 13 meter circle and it's absolutely beautifully balanced, you know, the comment is going to be circle small, but lovely balance. And maybe that's going to be an eight. And so when you look at a flying change, you think, well, that's a third level movement. And here, you know, here is Sarah riding second level and she did a flying change. So yay, Sarah. But no, because that is honestly a mistake. The purpose of the counter canter is to demonstrate that you can balance your horse in the counter lead. And the counter canter and cantering on the wrong lead are not the same. And I think that's something that's very difficult for people to understand.
Right.
And it took me, honestly, it took me a long time to figure out that they were different. But the counter canter does a few things for your horse. The counter canter helps balance your horse. The counter canter helps straighten your horse. And you want to demonstrate that your horse is truly on the aids and listening to you and stays in the canter lead that you want, and that you are sitting correctly to maintain the canter lead that you want. So if you're supposed to be in counter canter and your horse does a flying change, you've just told me that you're not sitting properly. Now, what I do see is a lot of people have started, training the flying changes. And so their counter canter, they have their horses really overbent in the direction of the lead because they're trying to prevent the flying change. And again, that's a mistake. You are telling me that your seat and leg aids, that your balance aids are not correct and that you cannot maintain the lead that you want. I know when I first brought Tiger home, no matter what happened, when I went across the diagonal, he did a flying change. I could not prevent the flying changes.
Okay.
And I was so excited when I was finally able to ride the counter canter, even though this is supposedly an upper level horse, you know, and I'm not trying to do upper level movements. I wanted to make sure that my horse was truly on my aids, doing what I wanted, not having an expectation of something. So in the counter canter, the flying change is a mistake. If you can walk or even trot, get your correct lead, your counter lead back.
Okay.
Because otherwise it's going to be a bad score. If you don't have enough time to do it, you don't have enough time to do it. And it just is a bad score.
Okay.
In the simple changes, when I teach them to people, I tell them that there are three pieces to the simple change. It is the canter-walk transition, it is the walk, and it is the walk-canter transition. Again, you're not really getting bonus points for doing it fast, you know?
Okay.
Or not walking at all. Again, you are demonstrating that your horse is on your aids, and you should show clear walk strides. Because again, you're not throwing your horse into a flying change. The movement is a simple change. It is a change of lead, quote, through the walk. That means walk strides.
Okay.
So if you do a flying change, my comment, and again, I'm judging schooling shows, not licensed competitions, but my comment is flying change is not required at this level. And, you know, in the further remarks, I may say, yay, nice, clean, flying change. But I'm probably going to give you a five or lower because you've changed leads, which is sort of the heart of the movement, but you haven't done it correctly.
You didn't really do the movement though, did you?
No.
Yeah.
No, you really didn't. I mean, I'm nice. I'm probably going to give it a five. Probably deserves a three. I did a fabulous continuing education with Lilo Four, and it was called Are You Satisfied? And her thing was, you know, you see a movement and you say to yourself, am I satisfied? And if the answer is yes, it's how satisfied am I?
Oh, I love that.
You go up in your scores. If your answer is no, how dissatisfied am I? And if I see a flying change at second level, I laugh because to me, I know that means that the person has started to look at the flying changes and yay, the horse is being, you know, a nice volunteer, you know, whatever. But you're supposed to be doing a change through the walk.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're training the flying changes, it's awesome when your horse does a flying change and you're not going to discipline them for it.
Right.
You're not going to punish them for it. But that isn't what you asked for with the simple change. And what it tells me is that you are not riding with correct aids well. Mm-hmm. Because if you go across the diagonal with an upper level horse and you're cantering and you do the aid to walk, they walk. They don't do a flying change because your aid for a walk transition is not your same aid as a flying change aid.
100%. Yes.
So, you know, the answer, Sarah, is, you know, no, that's not good. You don't get bonus points for doing flying changes. And, you know, that's also true for, you know, for first level test three, when you go across the diagonal and you do, you know, a change of lead through the trot. Mm-hmm. And again, there are three pieces to that movement. It's the canter trot transition. It's the trot. And then it's the trot canter transition. And rushing through that does not impress me.
Right.
Riding it well and balanced. And, you know, people will say, well, how many walk steps am I supposed to have? How many trot steps am I supposed to have? And, you know, my answer is enough walk or trot steps that you show me that you are truly in the gait and balanced and can do the new transition.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, maybe that's three steps.
Mm-hmm.
And for other people, maybe it's five or seven steps.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally rarely say, too many steps, you know, too many walk steps between, you know, transitions, because I would rather see somebody take the time to balance. Because if it took you seven strides of walk, the chances are pretty good that you are changing your balance. You are changing where your legs are. You are changing where your seat bones are. You're waiting for your horse to acknowledge that. And then you're asking for the aid. And I would rather see a well-planned aid than a rushed aid that ends up in something that's unbalanced and not so good.
That makes a lot of sense. And I do think people, because they get so anxious about the movement that they rush through, but giving them this, as we talk about with Dr. Wendy, giving them that grace, take your time, set it up.
Yeah.
It's going to be a better... And I always think, which is the better mistake? Like what you were saying about somebody holding the bend too much in the counter canter, it is a mistake. Which is the better mistake? And I don't even know that there's a solid answer to that. It's the mistake that sets you up the best for the next best movement that you can do.
Exactly. And I think that is the skill of riding in the ring. If there is a movement that you know is difficult for you and your horse, or if there's an uh-oh in your test, you've already screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
The score is already not great.
Mm-hmm.
Do what you need to do to set your horse up for success for the following movements.
Yes. Because they've already scored it and they're moving on.
Exactly.
Don't be the one that gets attached to the past mistake.
Yeah. I mean, I was on Facebook this morning and somebody I know had shown over the weekend and posted that, you know, she had a difficult time in one of her tests and that she made the decision to make a circle and took the 2-point error, knowing that it was an error, but knowing that if she didn't take the time to rebalance her horse, that she wasn't going to be able to do the subsequent three movements.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's better to take a -2 and then get a 6.5, a 7, and a 7.
Yes.
Than to get the 4 and a 5 and a 5.5 and a 5.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and that's being able to be in the moment of the test.
And I do think sometimes some horses will anticipate
Yes.
Movements. And it may not even be that you necessarily set the movement up badly, but sometimes, whether even when we don't want to, sometimes you do have to school your horse in the show ring.
Yes.
I'm not suggesting that that's an every show thing.
Or that you're aggressive with it.
Right.
But you're
right.
One of the scores is submission. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not kowtowing, you know,
correct.
It's not, you know, the horse doesn't do anything, but it is supposed to be about the horse waiting for us to tell them what we want. And if they're anticipating, you know, wow, what a nice volunteer horse, but wait for me,
mm-hmm.
because I'm the one who knows what's going on and you don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for that insight about what to do with the anticipated change in second level. Yes.
Stop thinking. Just stop thinking.
Oh, excellent. All right. Well, we're going to go to our interview with Dr. Wendy, but first we're going to have a word from our sponsor. From short training tips to how-to videos and insider access to private clinics and lessons, learn from top dressage experts with Equestrian Plus. Watch exclusive interviews and lectures, slow motion demonstrations, and step-by-step tutorials taught by top-level pros, and explore cross-discipline topics such as groundwork, rider fitness, and stable management. Visit equestrianplus.com to sign up for a 7-day free trial with subscription. And we're back. We're here today with Dr. Wendy Rice of both Rice Psychology in Tampa, Florida, and the ADD Equestrian, which is kind of more based out of Ocala. Would that be a fair statement, Wendy?
It would be.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. So excited to have you here.
I am so thrilled.
So,
thank you.
Did you show this weekend?
I did not show this weekend. Okay. I am going to Wellington in 2 weeks and then one more WEC in the first week of October. And then I go to the National Horse Show at the Kentucky Horse Park in October for the medal finals.
And this is your second year going to medal finals?
This is my third year. I'm hoping third year. Time's okay. The charm.
Well,
that's
getting
exciting.
There is half the battle, isn't it?
Yes. I did ride all weekend, and I am in boot camp mode.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we always like to give our listeners a little bit of background on our guests. So tell us about Wendy. How did Wendy get where Wendy is in her career? How did Wendy get where Wendy is with her riding? And how did you manage to combine your two things into doing something amazing for other people?
Wow, that was a big question. Okay. So I was probably born horse crazy, but didn't know till I was about 8. And I went to Bryn Mawr Camp in Honesdale, Pennsylvania, and I took 3 lessons on a horse named Willing, a Palomino, in a lunge ring. And then I was sunk. And I went to camp till I went to college, and thank God, because I got to ride a ton. And I really think that, because I was a once-a-week lesson rider. And
okay.
But I begged, I borrowed. I finally got my driver's license and did my first half lease. I grew up on Long Island riding more or less hunter jumpers. I went to Skidmore College and got to ride a lot and had a bit more of an introduction to dressage there. And then I did my junior year abroad, and I had been a working student for Julie Ulrich in Middleburg, Virginia, and she hooked me up with a woman named Minette Edwards, who taught me classical dressage for 6 months when I lived in London. And that was incredible. I had no stirrups. I had no reins. I had very long legs, and I did lots of really interesting exercises. So fast forward, I finally figure out that I should maybe become a psychologist, having no idea what I was in for. So now I'm a psychologist. But I was a working student for Julie Ulrich, and I learned at 18 or 19 that I needed to make enough money to ride as an amateur because I was not a professional horseman, horsewoman. I just knew that I loved this and I needed to keep it in place. So people would always say, you know, why don't you use horses in your work? And I did, I have a little bit here and there, but being like an equine assisted therapist, not really my jam. And I kept it separate for a really long time. And I guess I've struggled. Our topic today is imposter syndrome. It is mm-hmm. near and dear to my heart. And I didn't feel like I had anything to offer for a long time in the equestrian arena. And then little by little, being at horse shows, I started talking to people and I was helpful. And people in Ocala knew that I was a psychologist and they would sometimes call me and say, hey, so-and-so is walking this course. Do you mind joining us? Or do you mind helping? And so off the cuff, I ended up doing a little bit of stuff. And I was finding that I was watching lessons and I could translate a little bit from the rider to the trainer and say, I wondered if you tried this. And, you know, and in Hunter Jumpers, we count strides. So tempies, right? Mm-hmm. And so when kids can't count strides, why? Well, sometimes they have a learning disability or sometimes they have ADHD or sometimes they're so nervous that their brains aren't working. And I just found that I was loving working with riders. And so I finally decided to marry the two. I spent a lot of time in Ocala at WAC, at the World Equestrian Center, and I decided to kick off the ADD Equestrian. And it is a... coaching and therapy, sports psychology to help riders with focus, with learning, with anxiety, in and out of the show ring. And it mm-hmm. has been incredibly rewarding and amazingly successful as a girl with a little bit of imposter syndrome. I haven't been found out. I haven't been found out yet. And people are excelling in their riding and in their lives. So I spent time riding with Stephanie. So I have some dressage and biomechanics background now, which has been incredibly helpful. And I ride Hunter Jumpers in Ocala with Lauren Schweppe, but I speak enough dressage that hopefully what I am here to talk about is going to feel applicable.
Awesome.
Well, I think that riding is riding and all of the issues that people deal with in riding are the same cross-discipline, don't you? I mean, whether it's barrels or dressage or jumpers, you know, we're all dealing with the idea that I don't belong here.
Yeah.
And eventually somebody's going to figure out that I don't. And isn't right. that sort of the definition of imposter syndrome, that we don't
Why
belong
Why would someone
here?
Listen to me?
Yeah.
As opposed to everybody else. Yeah.
Well, it's funny how it sneaks up, and I think it certainly is an issue in riding, but it's an issue for many people across the different things that they are supposed to be doing competently in their lives.
Where did imposter syndrome originally come from?
So there were two psychologists who came up with this in the late 1970s. Both, I think, therapists, and in being therapists and then existing in academia, they came across people who, and I'm going to quote from the original article, that despite their earned degrees, scholastic honors, high achievement on standardized tests, praise, and professional recognition from colleagues and respected authorities, these women, and it was more women, and it still kind of is, do not experience an internal sense of success. They consider themselves to be imposters. So it's like they maintain an internal belief, I should say we, that we are not that we are not intelligent. In fact, they're convinced, or we are convinced, that we've fooled anyone who thinks otherwise. And so that's kind of the definition of imposter syndrome. So I have late in life ADHD, and I always thought I was stupid because I have a little trouble with getting stuff out of my memory. So I would say, you want me to help you solve problems, but you don't want me on your Trivial Pursuit team because my long-term retrieval of facts or knowledge, that's not my forte, but I can solve my way out of a paper bag over and over, different size paper bags, different shape paper bags. Anyway, so I went to Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, and you know, the week before graduation, I get a call, and I'm being inducted into Phi Beta Kappa.
Oh my God!
Wow!
Right, which is insane to me because again, I'm the not smart person, and so the story I told myself was that my college had a quota to fill, and they had to find one more person. So they chose.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So if that's not a definition of imposter syndrome, pardon?
Wow.
So sad.
Right?
Yes.
But I think we can recognize it in other people that we admire, but we can't necessarily see it in ourselves when we're doing it to ourselves.
Right. And so, you know, it shows up, and we're going to get to the horse part, but it shows up where if you have a successful test, maybe it's because the judge was nice and she scores with leniency versus I got a good score because I really practiced and I was prepared and I executed the movements well from an objective standpoint.
Right.
Like what do you attribute success? So people with imposter syndrome are likely to attribute their success to factors outside of themselves.
Yes.
And the super I would say the people and the super cocky people will always take credit for their success. And when the imposter syndrome, the person who struggles with imposter syndrome doesn't do well, it's all their fault. So when they don't do well, it's an internal cause. Yeah. Comes from the inside of me. And when they do well, it's because of, you know, an external cause.
That makes sense.
Well, that just summed me up in a nutshell. Thank you.
I'm here for you.
We're getting free therapy on a Monday morning.
Okay, well, she's described me, but now how do we fix it?
Yeah.
We don't need to get there yet.
There are so many different things that we can do.
Okay.
Do you think that it's more... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to give credit where credit is due. So it's Pauline Clance and Suzanne Imes coined the term in 1978.
Okay.
And just a soundbite. It was observed among high achieving women who, despite their successes, doubted their competence. And that really is what it is.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting that it is more prevalent in women than men. And I'm thinking about like our riding culture versus the riding culture in Europe, let's say. And when I lived in Germany, riding and being a trainer and a coach was actually quite a revered situation. You know, Herbert Rabin or Rainer Klimke, people looked to these men. They were icons. The local Joe Blow would go to watch a horse show. They had no interest in horses, but they watched a horse show the way we watch football because they admired the humans, but there's a lot more men over there, or there used to be. So it's interesting even there that it was it's been a much more accepted profession. Whereas over here, I think, I mean, I was thinking when you said, you know, that you realized you had to get a real job so that you could afford to be an amateur. It's one of the things my parents said to me is go to college, get a job so you can afford to own your own horse. If you're a professional, you'll just be poor and only ride other people's horses. We do not look at this as a legitimate sport and a legitimate profession.
I'm going to say I don't agree with you there, Steph.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm going to say that I think that most parents, when their kids want to do certain kinds of activities, play football, play basketball, ride horses, be musicians, act, write, you know, the arts and sports, I think most parents say, get a college degree and then do the other thing as a hobby because there are so few people who have the skill to be successful. You know, you think about how many Olympic athletes there are out of how many people actually do a sport. So I don't know that it's not a legitimate sport so much as our parents want us to be able to be successful and take our passions and keep them fun.
That's a good point. That is a good point. I just think about like when I introduce myself to people, I'm like, well, you know, I'm a horse trainer. Right there. That's kind of putting it. Maybe there's a little imposter syndrome.
So maybe we need to work on your elevator pitch.
Going down, not going up.
See, when I introduce myself, I say I help people enjoy their leisure time.
There we go.
I help people take their fun and make it better.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, it's definitely so much more than a horse trainer. I'm going to get back to you on that. We'll work on that for you because you're way more than a horse trainer.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're a life changer.
Well, thank you.
Talking about imposter syndrome, you know, we're considering ourselves sort of lower level kinds of people on the food tree. I wondered if everybody experiences imposter syndrome, even, you know, big fancy people who we all look up to, you know, Olympic athletes or, you know, people who win Pulitzer Prizes or whatever, that it's sort of ingrained into who we are and that maybe the confident and the cocky people are hiding that imposter syndrome feeling as well?
People from any level of success, including Olympic athletes, can have imposter syndrome. Hopefully, if you've made it to the Olympics, you have some tools to manage it. But feeling like I don't belong here, or they're going to find out I don't really have it, or it was a mistake, is something that it's sort of indiscriminate in terms of how it can attack people. And because by definition, it affects people who are successful. Those are the most successful people. So for sure, high achieving Pulitzer Prize winners, like it definitely has a bit to do with, you know, your personality and stuff. So if you're, again, I use the word cocky, but maybe extremely confident, you're not apt to have it.
Okay. So they're not just covering it up. They really don't feel this way internally.
There are people who really believe, have like legitimate confidence and believe they are competent and believe they belong there and believe that they earned it and can see things objectively.
That must be so nice.
I know. I've met people who believe that they deserve to be where they are in life. And it's fascinating.
I think my husband is one of them.
He could be.
Well, okay. So why do some people experience it and some people don't?
So it has to do with a bunch of different things. Partly it can originate from your family of origin. So in some families, they talk about being told that maybe your sibling is super intelligent and capable and always sort of being compared. And no matter what you do, you are never going to measure up. So you work your butt off and you achieve, you work and you try. But no matter what, you sort of believe the lore that your family portrays, which is that your sister, brother is the intelligent one and you're never going to quite measure up. So you just work really, really hard. And like part of you is like, wait, I am smart. But part of you believes this myth that families can carry on. Another option is like when you grow up and your parents are like, oh, you're amazing, you're smart, you walked early, you read early, you did everything early and well. And then you believe that if you struggle with something, you must not be smart or capable because the lesson that you've internalized is success without effort. Mm. So if you have to put in effort, then you must not really be so smart or so capable. So those are sort of two family dynamics that can kick this off. Also, people with some low self-esteem who just don't feel good about themselves and, you know, people who have a lot of self-doubt. There's something called cognitive distortions, which are just sort of thinking mistakes that we make. So like when we blow things out of proportion, that's a thinking mistake, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I mentioned earlier about attribution theory, if you always attribute your success to something outside of yourself, like I did well on the test because the test was easy, right? You don't really develop that internal sense of I can do it. I really can do it. I have what it takes to be successful. Mm. So that constant self-doubt, discounting success, right? Because it was a kind judge. Even you and I actually, Stephanie, both know some people who feel like they don't deserve their horses. Like my yes. horse has more talent and I am doing my horse a disservice by not letting somebody better than I am ride my horse. Well, again, yes. we all know the horse doesn't care, right? But maybe I shouldn't do this because, you know, I'm not good enough. And then, you know, comparing yourself. Well, I don't belong here, right? Because I'm not as good as so-and-so. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to compare yourself to other riders, you know, who have different finances than you, different access to coaching. And it just can fuel that sense of not measuring up. And the last thing is, you know, dressage, all disciplines of riding are pretty, it's a high achieving culture, mm-hmm. right? Especially if you do compete. And it attracts a lot of type A personalities and perfectionism. People who are perfectionistic tend to be somewhat black and white in their thinking. So I am either perfect or I am a failure. And I don't know you, but I'm not often perfect in the saddle. I'm mm-hmm. sometimes better than I was yesterday. And sometimes it feels really right. And the stars align and I'm really in sync with my horse and my timing is great. And my aids, are precise and my horse is in a good frame of mind. Right. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. perfectionism is like, it's the kiss of death.
Oh yeah.
Do you think, I was thinking about how the horses play into this. If you, let's say you buy the schoolmaster of your dreams. This horse has been there, done that. Do you think that that can make you feel like more of an imposter? Or do you think that it can actually buoy you up? Like, my horse knows more than I do. This is the horse doing it. Or my horse should do this for me because he knows. Which way do you think that tends to go?
I don't think it tends. I think it tends to go in both directions based on okay. the personality and emotional fortitude of the owner. Because some of us would buy the schoolmaster and be so grateful that we were fortunate to have it. You know, I have a horse that is highly trained. And when I do it right, he does it right, but he doesn't let mm-hmm. me get away with squat, right? So he's not a schoolmaster, but he mm-hmm. is highly trained. So when I ride well, it goes well. And I mean, he can be not in a great mood sometimes, but, you know, we know that. So I think, but if you're a person who believes that you have to be your horse's equal, or I'm not being very articulate here. I think it depends on the mindset of the person who buys that horse and why they're buying that horse. So if you are a training level rider or, you know, if you are not a pre-St. George rider and you buy mm-hmm. a Grand Prix schoolmaster, you bought him hopefully to teach you things and to reduce the gap between his skill and your skill. And you okay. bought him as yes. your experienced teacher. So if you can say, I'm so fortunate to have someone who knows more than I do, it's sort of green horse, green rider, or well-trained horse, green rider. You know, mm-hmm. there's so much to be gained. And, you know, your horse is reinforcing you for asking correctly. And your schoolmaster, you may have a schoolmaster who gives it to you even if you don't ask correctly. Or you may have a schoolmaster who says, you better do it right, girl.
Yeah.
So it so depends on the mindset. So if you are a person who has a schoolmaster and you're feeling really badly about yourself because you can't make your schoolmaster do what the previous rider could get him or her to do, then you may want to work on your thinking about it and your mindset about it a little bit, because it may have less to do with your riding and more to do with how your beliefs about your horse and yourself.
I okay. think that's something really important. I like that you just said that, because some of it is our belief system and how we approach things. And, you know, I think maybe the goals in what we're doing. I think about how many times people go for a lesson and what they want to hear is, that's good, you're doing everything right. But isn't the goal of going to a lesson to do it wrong? So that the instructor can tell you how to do it right and make it better. Yeah. But we judge ourselves on the quote failures rather than judging ourselves on our ability to learn.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much to being coachable. and to learning. And there are people who really struggle with feedback and who, you know, would ride in front of a Stephanie and want to get it all right. But, you know, Stephanie has x-ray vision. She can like see into your cells in your body, and she knows where you have tension, and she knows what your left cheekbone is doing before you do. But being coachable,
sneaky Stephanie.
Oh, she's very sneaky. That Stephanie. She knows a lot of. She knows a lot of things about a lot of things.
I got the special Mary Wandless X-ray vision glasses.
Yes. Yeah, no kidding. So I think there are people who go into a lesson, and they probably go into all walks of their life with the same thing. Right? Tell me I'm good, because it's like a dagger to my heart if you tell me I made a mistake, because maybe they really have a lot of all or nothing thinking. I'm either perfect or I'm a failure. Right? Yeah. And they, you know, having sort of a learning growth mindset is really how we want to approach. We want to approach not that my skills are set or my intelligence or capabilities are set, but that they are plastic and they can change and they can improve. And doing it all perfectly in a lesson is unrealistic. And you're not a failure if the person who's teaching you finds things that they can support you with and help you with. That is why you're there. But I think there's a lot of people whose self-esteem is really fragile, or whose self-esteem is ginormous, and there isn't room for that.
Yeah,
for them.
Do you think that there, amongst writers, that there are people whose self-esteem is very much wrapped up in the how well the horse does? Like if they have a good performance that day, the horse gave a good performance, the horse, you know, rode well, that they feel good about themselves as a person. But if the horse didn't go well, they take that very personally.
Definitely.
Okay. And realistically, the two aren't necessarily tied in.
You know, if you're playing baseball, it's a ball. And yes, there's weather and there's wind and there's the pitcher and all that. But like, we are coming at this from a whole other perspective and direction. And our balls have personalities and they have levels of hydration. I don't like this. Or, you know, there's a plastic bag over there. So I think we have to be really, really careful about measuring our self-worth and our success based on our horse's mood of the day. And I also think this is a partnership. And if you're feeling badly about yourself, your horse is going to pick up on that. And if you're feeling super nervous, your horse is going to pick up on that. So yes, like the horses come to the arena with, I don't know, a set of mental, emotional, and physical characteristics and prior experience. And as do the riders. And it's not so much that there's luck, because we know that there's training and conditioning and nutrition and all of that, but we don't have control over a lot of it. Like, you can be in a really good headspace and your horse can have an off day. And so I think, you know, there's a psychologist who talks about giving the most generous interpretation of behavior, right? So if your horse has an off day, it's okay for your horse, you know, like, we didn't do well today because my horse just was having an off day, or we didn't do well today because I was having an off day. It's nobody's fault. Sometimes it just happens, you know, and it's not about blaming. It may be about what can we learn, but I think we have to be careful. And, you know, I think we want to be sure we really give credit to our horses who step up to the plate in all sorts of insane circumstances.
Oh yeah.
Sure. Well, that was another thought. The thing, can feeling this worry about imposter syndrome, can it affect your horse?
Definitely. It just made me think about, for so long, my goal when I was horse showing was just not to embarrass, like not to stand out in a bad way. Yes. And I never felt that I belonged. And still, I struggle a little bit with I can't believe I'm here. I'm feeling a little bit like maybe I'm okay and I belong, but it's a struggle. And so, you know, it can show up, you know, we know so much about like negative thinking can really have such an impact on how we ride and how we present ourselves. And so, you know, maybe if you don't feel like you belong, you're going to feel more nervous. A lot of people are very worried about what spectators, you know, what are my friends, my trainers, my fellow competitors going to think about me? I don't belong here. And thinking, I can't do this. I shouldn't be doing this translates into how we ride. So I have a couple of trainers I ride with now, and one of them is really good about saying, you have the ability to do this, Wendy. You are capable of doing this. And, you know, I want you to sit up and remember that you can do this, and approaching this with confidence. And she's right. I do it all the time. I don't necessarily feel like I can do it all the time, but I can deliver when I remember that I can do that. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so, and when you are not sure heading into, I don't know, the free walk that your horse is going to actually walk and not jig a little or not trot, well, you're thinking that and you're not so consciously telling the horse, you know, if you say don't jig or don't trot or don't like melt into the canter when I'm wanting a free walk, that is a lot of noise. Right. Yeah. So that can really affect your horse. You've sort of got to feel the gates, feel what you want, be clear in your thinking and your intention, because the horses pick up on our conscious and our not so conscious stuff. They're prey animals. Like it's all about feeling with them. And so it can really impact the horse. And nerves, we know, are brutal. Right. Mm-hmm. So you know, we have the schoolmaster who maybe can absorb our nerves and will do it anyway. You know, years ago, I was buying a horse and I said to the trainer, why would you want to buy me the horse? Not buy me the horse. Why would you want to advise me to buy the horse that would listen to me? Why wouldn't you just buy me the horse? It knows what to do. It would be much safer for all of us if you just buy me the horse that knows what to do. And, you know, so anyway, it's kind of a joke. So that's, you know, I have been dealing with this my whole life as a psychologist, as a rider, like this is near and dear to my heart.
Is it something that you think that we can get over? Because I feel as if I learn the lesson over and over and over again. You were talking about, you know, thinking about what the railbirds are saying. And I remember going to a horse show and riding the horse that I bred, who I was very, very successful with. And there was somebody on the rail and I knew that she was talking to the person next to her, who I also knew, and they were saying bad things. And at the end of the test, the other person walked up to me and said, you know, we loved watching your test. And so said, she's so thrilled to see you riding so well on such a nice horse. And I thought, see, you have this magical thinking that's wrong. Stop worrying about it. Sometimes people are saying nice things and sometimes they aren't saying anything about you at all. But how do we keep, how do we learn those lessons so that they stick? Or can we?
We definitely can. You know, there's a lot of different, we can. And my guess is by now you probably more or less have, but we care what other people think. We live in, we are social beings. And part of like survival is not having people hate us and think that's, you know, that is, you know, it's sort of like in our DNA to some degree. But I think I've talked to people lately about staying in the ring, staying connected with your horse. Stephanie taught me a lot about being mindful and being present and leaving my phone in the barn and taking a minute to connect with my baby horse before I got on. And that lesson has served me really well. And when I talk to ADD equestrian clients about their fears about embarrassment was where I was going. Sounds like
interesting slip of the tongue.
Very interesting slip of the tongue.
My trainer's going to fire me.
Right. Well, that is not an unusual thought, right? If I fall off again, I'm out, right? You know, or my trainer is hiding behind a pillar because she doesn't want to be associated with me. I have to put somebody else's name as the trainer down on my injury. Okay, sorry. But I think learning to be in the ring and be connected and present with your horse because that's your focus. Because if your mind is on what are they saying about me on the rail, well, then you're definitely not present on your next movement and makes it really, really hard. But I also think, so I was in high school and I was worried about something. And Glenn Pollack, who was the school psychologist, said, you're not that important. Like, people aren't always talking about you.
Yep.
And I have a book that I use with kids who struggle with social anxiety and being judged. And we talk about it's sort of, you feel like you're in the spotlight all the time. And granted, when you are doing it, you are in the spotlight. Everyone is watching you. But really, they could give a shit. Like, it's when it's over, it's over. And, you know, maybe they talk about you for a minute or whatever. But, you know, it's not the terrific people who are saying bad things about other riders.
Yeah.
It's the terrific people who are, it's the terrific people. You know, sometimes I say to someone, well, do you respect their opinion, those people who don't say nice things about you? And they're like, no. I was like, so what they think about you ain't none of your business. Right?
Like, and it isn't
whatever.
Relevant. Yeah.
It isn't relevant at all. And we don't want people saying bad things about us. And certainly in the age of social media, it's brutal. If you're going to put yourself out there, you know, people are going to say good things and bad things. And when you put yourself out there to compete, we don't have control over what people think and what they say. And it feels bad when people say bad things about us. But I think your lesson is an important one. And I think then it can be, you know, since you had that amazing experience, whenever you see people who you think are talking about you, you'd be like, I don't know. I'm not going to mind read. Right.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be a fortune teller and a mind reader. I don't know what they're saying. Could be something good, but doesn't matter. It's none of my business.
And it might even be what to have for lunch.
Absolutely.
Because as you said, we are not that important all the time.
Well, And when you said that, it made me think about something my Bible study leader says. She says, none of us are special and we're all God's favorite at the same time. So if none of us are special, then why is anybody paying any more attention to you than anybody else out there? Yet you get to stand out within, you're in your field. You're in your arena. This is your moment to shine, but yeah, you're no more special than anybody else.
And I think that's really hard. And I think holding sort of this dialectic, how can I be special and not special? How can I be unique and not, you know, and so in dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, which is a therapeutic orientation, we talk about, I'm okay how I am and I can do more and improve. You know, and still work. And how can we hold these, I'm okay as I am, and there's room for improvement at the same time. But I think being okay with yourself and battling imposter syndrome to some degree relies on or requires the ability to, and to be like, to have the wherewithal to take riding lessons and to be criticized and get feedback. On some level, you got to be like, I'm okay and I can be better.
Well, I think we think that about our horses all the time. You can be super happy with your, like Aviva, how old is your horse?
23.
Okay. And you just love riding him.
He's a
unicorn. He makes you happy.
He's a unicorn.
But you don't show. And that is also okay. So there's two things. If, you know, if Dante's doing fourth level, I don't look at this as why isn't he doing pre-St. George? I look at, I am super happy with him doing fourth level. So we're able to do that for our horses to hold two different truths at the same time. But I don't know that we do it for ourselves.
Right.
With as great of ease.
A little bit of giving ourselves grace.
Yes.
And the benefit
so give
of
us some,
agreed.
Give us some tools. Give us some tools, Dr. Wendy.
Can I take a pill?
The red one or the blue one?
Yes. You definitely can take a pill.
Or
you
wine.
A little more
grape juice.
grape juice, right? Probably the first glass of wine can help, but the second is not going to help.
Yes.
So strategies. First of all, labeling it and being aware that this is something that plagues you is a first step. Like, the evidence is I've had a lot of success And I still feel like I'm faking it. And I still feel like any minute somebody's going to be, she does not belong here. Or you're going to fail and you're going to be found out, right? So recognizing that this is imposter syndrome talking rather than the truth, rather than reality, can be a first step. And like, there are times, and I don't know, Aviva, if you've experienced this, where like you could sit down and write a list of your accomplishments and like, okay, I deserve to be here. I've put in the work. I've done the training. I have demonstrated that I am capable and competent over and over and over again by virtue of this list, let's say, for example, right? Okay. And then when you're having, I don't belong here or I'm fake, right? You can say, hold on a minute. Is that imposter syndrome talking? So we kind of externalize this thing. You can even give it, you can draw a picture of it. You can make it an avatar so that when it rears its ugly head, you can say, whoa, get out of my head. Shut up. I'm not listening to you right now. I'm going to choose reality.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm.
So that's one thing. So number one, recognizing it. And number two, keep, you know, you could call it a competence file or an achievement file that nobody, like that you can't dispute. Because if you have achievement over, you know, if you have a list of achievements or accomplishments or successes or whatever, at some point it's not luck.
That's a good
point. I watch, you know, your social media feed, like I like gymnastics. So I watch a lot of tumbling, and there's this guy that tumble doctor or something, and he has a kid and she does like a back handspring. And then he says, okay, once is luck. Okay, do it again because I want to make sure it's not luck. And two, he says, is could be a coincidence. But three is a skill.
Okay.
And I like that. So, you know, keeping some reality checking, right, of past successes, of feedback that you've gotten from trainers, from friends, and progress, right? At the beginning of the year, maybe you could do, I don't know, a pretty good leg yield. And now you can do a half pass. Like, holy cannoli. That's huge development, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is, you know, we talk about SMART goals and we talk about setting goals for ourselves. But one of the things that I've learned recently is you can do like outcome goals, which is I'm going to learn to do a half pass. Or you can do identity-based goals. And identity-based goals is I'm the kind of rider who sets up her bend and pays attention to how her horse's legs are moving to da-da-da-da. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So I actually have an identity-based goal for myself because I am competing in some pretty big classes. I'm in the stadium at WEC. And I came out recently and I was like, I'm going in now feeling like I belong enough to show up, but I'm not good enough to win. But I am good enough to win. I have a good enough horse and I ride well enough and I am a competitor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was working on identity-based goals with a ADD equestrian teenager. And I wrote my own and I have it now as the screensaver on my phone. And it says, I am a calm, confident rider who belongs in the Derby ring, a true contender who leads with quiet authority, rides with intention, and trusts in my partnership to deliver a winning round no matter what comes up.
Oh, I love that.
That's awesome. It's something that your best friend would tell you.
It is. And that's a great idea. What would you tell your friend in this situation?
Yep.
Right. And what would your friend or your trainer say to you? You know, I am so grateful for the trainers that I've ridden with because often they have way more belief in me and my ability than I have in myself. And starting to, at almost 56 years old, internalize a little bit more of a sense of mastery. You know, I don't know, like, when I first started riding my young horse with Stephanie, I didn't know I had two seat bones. I was a little uneven. And sometimes my baby horse would sort of run through my left leg out of the ring.
Been there, done that.
Oh my God. Who knew that you needed to have weight in your outside
Both seat boats.
A little bit to like crazy. Push the horse in the ring, right? And so, you know, like getting on and instead of getting on and feeling like, oh shit, it's going to happen again, to get on and say, I know what to do, because it's so powerful when you can turn your horse from your outside edge and you don't need an inside rein. Oh my God, right? But so believing that a little bit. I am a rider who can, you know, who can manage a horse and effectively by engaging both sides of my body, whatever. Okay. The other thing is normalize it, because you would be shocked at how many other people feel the same way that you feel. So obviously, you know, you don't necessarily need to bring it up all the time or talk about it all the time, but it is for sure something. So one of the effective sort of therapeutic interventions is group therapy, because there's a lot of high achieving women or successful riders who feel this. And you could say to somebody, hey, do you ever feel like you don't quite belong here? Or, you know, that like at some point somebody's going to know, you know, you don't quite know how to do this or whatever. And you might be surprised because you're probably not alone. And then, of course, therapy, professional support for a psychologist or a psychologist or a mindset coach or, you know, read some books.
Or no, even talking to your riding coach about this. I mean, I know not all riding coaches are interested in dealing with this aspect of it. But it might be something that they can resonate with themselves, and they can tell you how they dealt with it at some point.
Sure, sure. I think that's really, really important. I think the good trainers, riding coaches are part therapist, part, you know, they deal so much with the emotional side of.
I do so much more therapy now than I did when I was a social worker.
There you go.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I will say that I went through a very difficult performance problem with show nerves. And I went to see a sports psychologist who was not a rider. She was actually a tennis coach, but she helped me so much with trying to figure out what my anxiety was, where it was, and how to address it in different ways. And, you know, I one of the things that she said to me, which I think you also said, is, you know, talk to yourself as if you're your own best friend, you know, because we talk to ourselves as if we're enemies so much of the time.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Showing yourself compassion, self-compassion. Actually, if that's something that someone's interested in, you can just really look it up. And DBT, dialectical, you can do like DBT, what is self-compassion, or how do you show yourself compassion? And you'd come up with all sorts of quick finds on that. But really, you're right. Giving yourself the benefit of the doubt and approaching yourself with grace and understanding and kindness is a whole lot more successful than being incredibly hard on yourself and criticizing yourself and judging yourself all the time. It's just really, you know, I think a lot of horse people come from like that old world, you know, where they were quote unquote breaking horses, you know, and training people, you know, harshly and beating them up. And those of us with imposter syndrome don't really benefit from that all that well.
No. Mm-hmm.
Well, this was incredibly enlightening.
Yes. So much food for thought.
Yes. Thank you.
See, what did I say? I said it was. Can I
it
just
was.
Say one more thing?
I did.
Really? That was helpful. Oh my God. So I went to Oprah did a tour years ago and I went to it, and she talked about interviewing the most successful entertainers like Paul McCartney or Elton John, or, and at the end of the interview, they would say, is that good? Was that okay?
Yeah.
Right. So
that's amazing.
You know, yeah. So yes, yes. The Olympians have it, and the most successful people still, we want to be understood. We want to be heard. We want to know that we're okay.
Well, I think about Stephen Peters coming up to this last Olympic Games, and he was really struggling with, I think they labeled it some depression, but some mental situations. And one of the things I love is what he did with his freestyle music. If you listen to his freestyle music, there are lyrics in it that say things like, it's going to be okay. This is a good day. And I thought, what a powerful way to just remind yourself when you're in that moment, in that level of competition, hey, you've got this. It's good. You're good. So we do have those tools to our disposal, even just amongst ourselves. Get a playlist that you like, music that really pumps you up, and, you know, ride to that.
So, and I think a lot of this really has, it's about mindset, right? And working on your mindset isn't just taking care of yourself, it's taking care of your horse.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. And having imposter syndrome doesn't mean you're not capable. It means you're human. And you have some self-doubt. And maybe we want to get it from imposter syndrome to maybe a little bit of self-doubt. And then to, okay, I got this.
We're never going to be cocky, though, so that's okay.
You know, I shifted cocky the other day with somebody to respectful, right? So you can go into the arena saying, like, I've got this. Like, I'm going to win this, and I've totally got this. Or you can go into the arena saying, I'm prepared, I'm trained, my horse is prepared, and I'm going to be respectful of these movements, and I'm going to treat them, even the simpler ones, with reverence a little bit. And, you know, because we want to maintain some humility and confidence at the same time.
That leaves space for, there's an error, let me fix it. Rather than you're just riding around going, no, this is fine. That, oh my gosh, it's not fine. Oh, everything's terrible.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Because every day with our horses, no matter what we're doing, like I can jump around a huge course or do my tempies and then have trouble picking up the canter the next day because I'm not quite precise or I'm not communicating clearly. And, or my horse is just like, yeah, no, I'm just not with you right at this moment. So
today's not the day.
Today's not the day. And that happens. And I think we have to really keep that in mind.
Awesome. Dr. Wendy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much for having me.
This Absolutely. Really fun, our pleasure.
As you said it would be. Yet again.